From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made Thursday, January 22nd, when one of the most powerful men in New York State turned himself in to the FBI. Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver's two-decade reign came to an end that morning, and just hours later, U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara delivered a detailed explanation for why Mr. Silver was arrested. Bharara said that Silver had used his influence and power to make himself very rich in a series of illegal schemes, and Bharara hinted that Silver is not the only political leader who has done so. Now, Silver vowed to fight the charges, but he has offered no public rebuttal so far, and in the following several days, there was a scramble to determine who would become the new Speaker of the Assembly. Came down to two men, essentially, a Bronx Democrat named Carl Hastie and Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli of Rochester. Perhaps it's no surprise that the New York City politician got the job, while Mr. Morelli will keep his role as Majority Leader. Did we witness the evidence that Upstate is simply not considered worthy of the top job? Joe Morelli's here this hour to talk about the business of rebuilding trust in Albany, state business. I think he brought the whole budget, and we... How many pages is that thing?
No, that's just a summary.
Oh, that's a summary of the budget. It's this huge thing. We're going to talk state business and much more. And that felt like to me, Joe, it felt like that's it. I mean, I even heard Keith Wright and a downstate assemblyman saying that they felt that it should be a New York City job. And I don't mean to be cynical. It's one thing to say, let's consider the best candidates for this role and let's choose them. But when you have a faction of political leaders saying, this is our turf, it felt like a slap to Upstate, was it not?
Well, I think there's no question that when you go through it, and obviously people always want someone from their community, right? So one of the questions was, I think the mayor of New York raised this, is I want a speaker who's going to be fair to New York City. You know, I had a conversation with him. I said, you know, I thought that was entirely appropriate. But by the same token, I didn't want that translated in or interpreted as in order for you to be fair to the city of New York, you had to live in one of its zip codes. Because I said, if that's true, if that's how we define these things, then should I assume then for the last 40 years or the last, frankly, 100 years since we've had an upstate speaker that Rochester hasn't been treated fairly simply because there's a speaker from New York City? I reject that. And I think what's interesting is I think a fair number of my colleagues, even from New York City, were coming around to it. You know, we didn't get enough support, but we were starting to build support in the city, but we sort of hit a ceiling, I think, and it became clear to me after just a few days that while our numbers were robust and all of Upstate, with few notable exceptions, were supportive of my candidacy. And actually a fair amount in what we call the suburbs, Long Island and Westchester, Rockland. You know, political considerations being what they were, it wasn't possible. But I'm not sure I'd consider it a slap. I think there's just certain alliances and certain relationships that have developed over the years, and it's harder for someone who lives hundreds of miles from what the folks in New York consider the center of the universe, which is New York City, to sort of demonstrate that you can effectively do the job.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I think, misunderstanding of Upstate. I think even the New York Times referred to Monroe County as a liberal enclave. Did you know this is a liberal enclave?
Yeah, I didn't really feel that was an apt description. I also was described at the New York Daily News editorial board as a hayseed from Rochester. I mean, I'm not sure. I don't really bale much hay, so I don't even know what I would do with a bale of hay. But, yeah, they have a different view. And interestingly, in some ways, I mean, no disrespect to them, they're actually more parochial and less worldly in some ways than people in other parts of the state, because we don't assume that everything begins and ends in Rochester, right? We know
sure.
That there's a big world out there. And I'm not sure that's always the case in New York City. But having said that, I had a number of colleagues from each of the boroughs who were very supportive and would continuously say, we think you're the best candidate and would make the best speaker. That's not to in any way, underestimate the considerable skills that Carl Hastie has. He's a very good legislator. He's a very good friend of mine. I think we both found it ironic and frankly disappointing that we ended up being adversaries in the race for speaker. But we have a long relationship. He's a terrific guy, and I'm very hopeful that under his leadership we will reform the body and reform the state government.
Well, there's a lot that confused me about that, and not the least of which was liberal enclave and hayseed. But outside of that, you know, I know that was a hard day when Sheldon Silver turns himself into the FBI. You're helping lead what must have been a hectic conference behind closed doors, and probably not the most fun day that you've had in your career, I imagine. But, you know, the complaint had been released. Preet Bharara is getting ready to hold his own news conference. And then you had to come out, and they essentially sacrificed you to come out and talk to the well, news media, and you had to answer some tough questions. I want to listen to what you said about supporting Sheldon Silver.
Right.
Even this is about 45 minutes before Preet Bharara is going to come out and essentially whack Sheldon Silver. This is what you said at the time.
Right.
I'm continuing to support the speaker, and I would say that the members overwhelmingly in the conversation that we just had are continuing their support, and there is a strong feeling, as I think we should all reflect on, that there is a presumption of innocence, and we have every confidence that the speaker is going to continue to fulfill his role with distinction.
Do you regret that now, Joe, saying that?
No, I don't regret saying it at the time. I think, you know, things don't happen. Things happen in real time, so you're trying to gather information. So my responsibility, as soon as the speaker had to return to New York to surrender as a result of the criminal complaint, of which I knew almost nothing. I was literally called at 1 in the morning and had a conference call with senior staff. I was notified by a voicemail that the speaker was leaving to go back to New York. It did not detail why. Obviously, it became pretty clear once the New York Times broke the story. So I immediately assembled with the senior staff at about 7 the next morning and began to prepare for the day. We had session that was planned. It was ultimately canceled. And I had to go behind closed doors with my colleagues in the majority, the 105 remaining members, and work through this. And what we knew at the time was very little. We hadn't seen the criminal complaint. We had not yet heard from the U.S. attorney. And there is a strong presumption, which you know, exists even to this day, that people have the right to defend themselves in a courtroom, find look at the evidence and be able to respond to it. So that was what we were dealing with at the time. When I went into conference, it was clear that there was a considerable support to continue to have the same leadership in place.
That's what your members wanted.
That's what the members wanted. It was overwhelming, and it was very strong. And it was, look, we're going to make sure that someone is allowed to present their side of the case, and until it becomes clear to us that this will be a distraction for which we can't operate. Once that happens, then obviously circumstances will change. And that's really what happened. So I went out, and I was joined by probably 60 members of the Democratic Conference, and as majority leader, it fell to me. That's my responsibility. So I was trying to give voice to what I had heard by the members in what was a relatively long conference, and said that we continued to support the speaker's ability to serve in a leadership role. What happened then is, which is probably part of the untold story, is one, members had a chance to look at the criminal complaint. And I think that was, frankly, a little bit of a wake-up call to us. We didn't know what the complaint was. And that's the other thing to bear in mind. I mean, now we have the value of having looked at it and gotten a lot more information. At that time, the only thing we had really known about was an earlier story in the New York Times by unnamed sources in the U.S. Attorney's Office, presumably saying that there was an investigation. So so then following that conference that you just played the clip from, we were able to read the criminal complaint. We also heard and saw the U.S. attorney make his arguments in a televised press conference. And then over the next weekend, I really made it my business to reach out to as many members as I could, not in an environment where they're all sitting together and everybody watches what everyone does, but to really have some private conversations with members to really find kind of off the record. And I'd said to them, you know, this isn't usually the way we operate, but this is an extreme circumstance. I need to know off the record without, attribution, how you feel as an individual about where we are. And what became clear to me over the next 48 hours was that there was actually much more anxiety about the speaker's ability to lead the conference and lead the House during this trial. And that really is what became, I mean, there's still many members who are strongly in the belief that he'll be exonerated, and that's their opinion. But the more important and really, frankly, for me, the only issue that really became important was whether or not it was going to cripple the House's ability to function.
Yeah.
And that's when I made the judgment that I had to provide some leadership and having him step down.
So much of what you had to do was assessing where the members were.
Right.
And that's, like you say, that's part of your job. At some point, when you read that criminal complaint, though, you're right. Everyone deserves due process.
Right.
And he'll get it. We haven't heard him offer a public rebuttal. But you've read the complaint now. You've seen what Preet Bharara said. Do you look at that and say, this looks bad. This looks likely to me that Sheldon Silver has done some things that are deeply troubling, if not criminal?
Well, I don't know if I've arrived at that conclusion. First of all, I'm not an attorney, and I don't know the nuance of what the federal law requires. I know a little bit more now than I did then about the standard of proof and what the charges mean. But that's sort of not really relevant to what my job is and what the member's job is. What he faces relative to the criminal indictment and what his actions were and whether they're ultimately he'll be exonerated or convicted, that's really for a courtroom to decide. For me, the more important question was, first of all, how do we continue to lead? I mean, I always say this, and I don't mean to be flippant about it. You know, the voters don't care about my life, nor should they, right? And they shouldn't care about the lives of the members of the legislature. It's supposed to be the other way around. We're supposed to be focused on and care about their lives. So that's really what triggered, you know, my efforts then over that, after that weekend, the next several days to you know, basically get the speaker to resign and to move ahead to the next stage, which was the election of a new speaker and now stabilizing the House. The only important part of it, because I don't want to leave this unsaid, is that what we will learn during this trial, both about what the speaker did or didn't do and how, you know, people view that, will be instructive to us in terms of changing the rules so we don't have this again. And that's been front and center. I mean, I've said publicly, we're not going to pass a budget, we're not going to end this session without having changed the ethics rules that relate to what people do in terms of outside income, whether it's the level of outside income they have or, more importantly, making sure that people can't use their public office in a way to benefit themselves privately.
Do you look at that, though, and say, I want to talk to Sheldon about this. Is any part of that criminal complaint really troubling to you?
Well, the suggestion that you would use your office to benefit you and that you didn't do anything to, which is essentially what much of this complaint is about, is that you were able to steer business and make referrals, get fees for referrals, and those referrals only came as a result of your standing in public office. And if that's the case, then he obviously is going to be convicted. If that's not the case, and he was playing a role as a lawyer separate and apart from his role as speaker, then he'll be exonerated. I think that's the central question. What's troubling about it is the suggestion that there were millions of dollars made here because of his position as a member of the state legislature. And that, frankly, is unacceptable.
So very...
But to your other point, I didn't want this to go unanswered,
sure.
Is I have had very few conversations with former Speaker Silver about the complaint. What he has said to me is he will be exonerated and the charges will not hold up. And that's all we've talked about it, partly because I think he can't say anything publicly because it would change his defense. And frankly, if he talked to me about it, I could be brought in as a witness of the case, even though I don't have any firsthand knowledge of the case.
This feels a little bit, though, like, hey, look, I'm not a scientist, so I don't know about climate change. I mean, I'm not an attorney, but I read that complaint and I say, I want answers from our speaker. I'm a taxpayer. I want answers. And if that were me, if I were Sheldon Silver and I was not guilty, this was all legit, the first thing I'd be doing is saying, this is how Preet's got it wrong here. I wouldn't let him steamroll that and let it hang instead of hiding behind closed doors and putting together a defense.
Well, I think he will do all of that, but I think probably what his lawyers are advising him is the more you disclose things publicly,
yeah,
the more you telegraph the pitch. It's a little like, you know, I don't want them to know what the defense will be because I think they've made errors in law, errors in fact, errors in judgment, and I'm going to wait until the trial because, remember, public opinion is nice and it's important if you're in politics and if you're running a government, but if you're a defendant in a legal case,
yeah,
it's less important.
All right, so for you, we'll let this play out, but at the very least, he should have to disclose how he's making the money. Even if it's ethical or even if it is not illegal, he should have to disclose it and all members should have to disclose, yes?
Yes, because if the public ultimately believes that you're benefiting from your role as an elected official, as a speaker, as a majority leader, and that you're privately benefiting from that, it's illegal, it's unethical, and it makes governing in the highest ethical levels impossible. So we will change that. Yeah, I think we run up against, you know, the big question is largely for attorneys. I mean, those are the ones that have the biggest opinion here. They're the ones who have clients. If you were providing consulting services for people in this manner as a private citizen, it would already be illegal. So I think the question is, how do we make sure the legal profession doesn't, you know, in a narrow sense, violate its ethical standards about revealing who their clients are, but at the same time has disclosure so that the public interest is safeguarded. And that's first and foremost. Of those two different objectives, the public interest is more important, in my mind, than the challenges it presents for an attorney who happens to be in the legislature.
You're saying that gets done this session?
I believe it does get done this session. I know that the new speaker and I are in agreement on this. We're searching for the right mechanism, the right way to do this. Obviously, I've talked to the governor about it. This is a priority of the governor's. I have not talked as much. I know that Senator Skelos is, at least if you take these rumors to be true, is being looked at the same way Speaker Silver is, and he's an attorney as well. I don't know what his feelings are about it, but I don't believe we can basically get through this session, nor should we, without making changes to the system.
What does the legislature think of Preet Bharara?
You know, I think anytime a prosecutor looks as though they're having a good time indicting people or seems to be enjoying this, this is a somber time. It should be. That's not to say anyone who hasn't violated the law shouldn't be prosecuted. They should. But I think there's some just concern about the glee with which it seems he's taking in developing investigations. Having said that, if he finds, you know, people guilty of crimes, we want him to prosecute. We want all the U.S. attorneys to prosecute, not only from the Southern District, but from the Western District, from the Northern District, et cetera.
I don't know if Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli is going to break any news on this program this hour. I have news just handed to me, literally as we sit here. This comes from the AP 3 minutes ago. Ex-New York State Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver has been indicted on 3 charges after being arrested in a federal bribery case last month. He was indicted Thursday by a grand jury in Manhattan federal court. The charges are honest services mail fraud, honest services wire fraud, and extortion under the color of his official duties. Lawyers Joel Cohen and Stephen Molo said they will fight for his total vindication, and Silver has said he is confident it will come. Yeah. So there we are. There's some news there. Carl Hastie is the speaker. As you say, you've known him for a good amount of time. What confused me a little bit about that is the speed of that process. I know that you have said behind closed doors when you knew you couldn't get the votes that it was essentially done. But at the same time that's happening, the news media is reporting that Carl Hastie was being investigated by Moreland a year ago, that he had racked up big bills to taxpayers with undisclosed expenditures. And so after Sheldon Silver's arrest, why elevate Carl Hastie until you know he's clean on all of that stuff?
Well, that's a great question. It's a complicated answer, which is, you know, we never really had – there's been no evidence and no information that – the speaker now, Carl Hastie, is under any kind of investigation. And it's one of the things that is troubling about this process, this environment, is that, you know, oftentimes there are leaks from unnamed sources. You know, everybody sort of assumes that those leaks come from the U.S. attorney or come from the FBI. But their response is always, and I guess this is standard operating procedure, we don't comment on any investigations. So you think about it from the point of a legislator, okay, I'm not really sure what to do with that information. You know, I had a number of conversations with Carl, both before there was a vacancy, during the time there was a vacancy, and leading up to his election about this. He has promised me over and over again that he is not under investigation, that Moreland looked at some things. They were satisfied. He's satisfied. I think it would have been, even though I had an interest in having my candidacy be moved forward, but I think it would have been really harmful to the institution if we simply said, well, some unnamed source somewhere says that someone may be under investigation, and as a result of that comment, you were disqualified from being considered in a leadership role.
But harmful to the institution even more would be Carl Hastie following Sheldon Silver right out of the Office on Corruption. Now, I'm not saying that's imminent at all, And I don't think there is evidence that it is. But I'm saying, shouldn't your chamber be absolutely certain that won't happen? Because if Carl Hastie somehow goes down, is the public ever going to trust your party to lead that assembly again?
Well, those are obviously all good questions, and they're important questions. When I went to meet with the Daily News editorial board about my candidacy, the first question they asked is, are you under investigation? And I said, not that I'm aware of.
Nobody's ever aware of it. I haven't even seen a hint that Joe is from anybody.
No. You know, by the way, neither
am I. Sheldon said he wasn't.
Well,
Dean says he doesn't know.
It's part of the challenge here. I said to them, not that I'm aware of. I mean, I guess I wouldn't know if I was, but I'm certain I've done nothing that would merit it. But that's sort of where Carl is. He said, I haven't done anything wrong. I mean, there were questions about his mother, which I thought were frankly terribly inappropriate. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm sure there's things that my great-grandfather did that I might not be happy about. I have no idea. But even if that were true, what does that have to do with my behavior? You ought to be judged on your individual behavior. Carl is, I've known him for 15 years. We not only worked on legislation together when I chaired the insurance committee, but we shared the responsibility of heading our respective county parties for a period of years. So we really bonded and developed a very close relationship. And he has always been incredibly honorable to me. He's always kept his word on everything he's ever told me. He works hard. He's not somebody who is anxious to be in front of TV cameras or has tried to gain press or attention to himself. So I feel comfortable. You know, would it be, if something happened to him, an ethical question were raised, it would certainly be damaging to the House. But as I said to anyone who would ask, you know, each of the 150 members of the state assembly and beyond that, the 213 members of the state legislature, all ought to be aware of increased scrutiny and all ought to be very concerned about what our behavior is like as it relates to our ethical responsibilities.
I've heard from a number of Democrats in the last 6 weeks who've said, if Joe Morelli is not chosen as speaker, I hope he comes back to run for county executive. We cannot sit this one out. You laugh. I hear people saying they'd love to see you do it. Not going to do it?
No. I frankly have much more responsibility under Speaker Hastie than I did under Speaker Silver, as much as, you know, I was made majority leader by the previous speaker. Carl and I are friends. He's asked me to play a much more active role in both the operation of the House in terms of the strategy of the House going forward. And really, this at the end of the day, it can't be about your personal ambitions. It really, and I've said this for a long time, I spent a long time in Albany, much of that in the trenches, trying to build the respect and cooperation of my colleagues. I've really gotten to a point now where I'm part of the leadership team. It seems to me I would have squandered an awful lot of time building those relationships, gaining that so-called political capital that could benefit my region by stepping aside now and doing something completely different. That might benefit me politically, but that's really not what this is supposed to be about.
And you are hinting that the old cliche of three men in a room is changing?
Well, you know, I've never actually believed that three men in a room existed. It is helpful in terms of how people view it because it's sort of a simple formula. But, you know, when we go into Democratic Conference, which we do for hours and hours to review and to make suggestions on the budget, there's really, you know, all the members of the Democratic Conference, 106 members, the Republicans do the same thing in party conferences. Those are really to identify priorities. And then it's the responsibility of the speaker and the leadership team to try to distill that down so that when we're negotiating with the governor and the Senate, we have a sense of what the priorities are. So, you know, it will change this year because the new speaker doesn't have the long service that Speaker Silver had. Doesn't have as much familiarity with the budget, so is going to expand decision-making. And I talk to him every day, and we talk about where we are relative to the budget. We talk about those things that the governor's clearly identified as priorities he wants to make sure are included in the budget, as well as the Senate. So we'll work through that. So I think this process is changing, and I think that's a good thing. But I think it was always an oversimplification to just call it three men in a room.
And certainly, the speaker does have a little more oomph to put some priorities out there. Carl Hastie has already talked about the DREAM Act, for example. If you had been chosen as speaker, what would you be standing up there saying, this is top of my list?
Well, I don't think there's any question that, the revitalization of the upstate economy has been a priority for me. I've also devoting a lot of time and attention now to dealing with the extreme poverty in the city of Rochester and in our community. Those probably would have been the two things in addition to education. And education is on everyone's mind. And it's not even so much the dollar amounts, although that's clearly an issue, but also the question of where we take educational policy. What is the role of standardized testing? What's the role of Common Core and higher learning standards? What's the role of teacher evaluation? So I think those three or four things would have been the things that I had focused most attention on. We have this bank settlement, which has given us, in a sense, a windfall, and I would have pushed for making certain that much of that ended up in infrastructure improvements.
When it comes to the upstate economy, the governor has talked about $1.5 billion, three pots of $500 million, a competitive situation. Everyone knows Rochester Finger Lakes is getting one of those $500 million pots, right? that's done, isn't it?
Well,
there's no way that we don't.
Well, I have mentioned to the governor that I certainly hope that we're given every consideration. I think...
Are you okay with that setup, by the way?
I am. I don't mind. It is interesting to me that a lot of people have complained Buffalo got the so-called Buffalo Billion without having to compete. You know, the governor has an explanation for that. And I think it's a valid one, which is Buffalo really was one of these persistently underperforming communities. Rochester's economy had always done better than Buffalo. And Rochester was better positioned by virtue of the industries we have and had and continue to have. So he also wanted to test the theory that if you invested a fair amount of dollars in an intensive way, you could encourage private investment to match that. And that has happened. Buffalo is doing much better. So
the billion is working, in your words.
The billion is working, although they haven't gotten anywhere near $1 billion yet. I mean, it's some commitments, but it's the private sector investment which has really driven it. It has to do with the psychology of having suddenly confidence in your community. I think that's what's working. So, okay, so that's done. And the one thing we've proved that is an intensive investment by the public in cooperation and conjunction with private investment can really change the way you look at a community and look at its and change its fortunes. So the governor now says, but I want these different regions now to really develop, hone their ideas and really develop their ideas about what's transformational in their region. So the competition, so-called competition, I guess, is really driving us to do that. So we've had Joel Seligman, the president of University of Rochester, and Danny Wegman, the president of Wegmans, co-chairs in the region. They're working very hard and have for several years at identifying those transformational opportunities. I'm proud to serve on that panel. And we have worked very, very hard. This is raising our game a little more because now we're competing for a much bigger pot of money. And I like Rochester's chances. Look, we have a very highly skilled workforce. We have a series of great institutions, particularly U of R and RIT as it relates to research in new technologies, new opportunities. We have the Eastman Business Park, which is an enormous asset, which we're redeveloping. We have the possibility of the Stamp Project in Batavia, which is between the Buffalo and Rochester regions, but has the potential for thousands of jobs and new technologies. So we have a lot of things that position us well. It would be great to have an infusion of public dollars to match up with private investments. And I think this is a game changer for us.
Republican counterpart, I don't even know if he was a counterpart. Yeah, let me back up and say, interestingly, on this program in the last month, Republicans who've come on have had a split view on the Buffalo Billion. Rich Funke, Mark Johns have said, looks like it's working. Bill Noje said it's working to help out a few select people, but there's still a lot of poverty there. And I think it looks to me like you're trying to walk and chew gum at the same time. You want to hit economic revitalization, but also poverty. And we should spend an entirely separate hour on the poverty initiative that's happening. And I'm looking at the man sitting next to you who helped schedule you, and you're going to get a separate call from me on that.
Good.
But briefly,
yeah.
I know that the mayor who was on the program, Lovely Warren, on Tuesday, said she's been working with you on that.
Yes.
When it comes to poverty here, this is so complex. How do you make sure that this is a real initiative as opposed to, there have been so many initiatives, Joe, you know that, for over years.
Right.
What is happening this time to address poverty in a real way in Rochester?
Well, it's a great question. It's a question a lot of people have been asking, and it's a question everybody should ask, right? So there have been other initiatives, not any that I've been involved in, so I don't have a firsthand rationale for
why. And I'm not saying they're a waste of time or not well-intended,
but
poverty is a big, big issue here.
Well, I start from this, a couple of important pieces of information for me in how to, deal with this. On the first, we have 15,000 jobs that go unfilled in Rochester right now that are that the need for the skill set or the skill level is what they call middle skills. So more than a high school diploma, but less than a four-year degree. So a two-year degree from a community college, a certificate, different kinds of post-high school education, but not needing necessarily a bachelor's degree. So 15,000 jobs. It's sort of, I mean, in what should be our sweet spot here, with a relatively highly skilled workforce, and yet we have these unfilled needs. On the other hand, we have a lot of people in poverty. You know, 30,000 children in the region, the second highest poverty rate in the country. So why aren't we connecting people in poverty to jobs that are going unfilled? And to me, that's a great opportunity, but it's also the great challenge. How do you make people ready for those opportunities? How do you give them the skills, not only technical skills, but how do you give them the sort of the so-called soft skills, the need to understand you have to go to work every day, that you have to work hard, that there's, you know, that there's a value set that needs to be commensurate with working in those jobs and working in those fields. So that's one of the opportunities. Why will this be different? Because I think we've identified what the real challenge is, which is there are a lot of services and there's a lot of agencies that provide services, but there really is no system that's dedicated to moving people from poverty to employment, from dependence to to independence, from, you know, the so-called handout to a hand up. That's what we're really about. And we're working with the county executive, who's been terrific, and Kelly Reed, who's her head of the Department of Human Services, has been very involved in this. The mayor, and unfortunately Del Smith is leaving, but other people to replace her, or him, Len Reedon, who's the deputy mayor, they've all been involved in this. And the question is, how do we piece this together to actually make a system where we can start to track individuals and their families, so we can start to develop individualized plans to move them from poverty to opportunity and hope. It's really bringing everyone together. This is the first time in my memory, we have over 80 different agencies working on this. We have, you know, hundreds of people that have volunteered their time and effort. We have the governor and virtually every one of his agencies and commissioners engaged in a task force to work with the local initiative. Peter Carpino, who heads the United Way, has been a great partner on this. He and his entire staff are devoted to this. We're getting, you know, kind of the buy-in that we haven't had before. And the idea is how to move people through this. It's not to keep people on, as the mayor says, a treadmill where you have basic needs met, but nothing more. It's got to be much more than that. So, and look, you know, Joel and Danny, I talked about, not only are they doing regional economic development, but they're very much engaged in helping us match up these opportunities with these the people who have challenges to connect all that. So we're working hard at it. You know, I don't know, you know, whether we succeed, but I'm very hopeful that this is an opportunity that we won't have again.
We're going to take the shortest break possible and come right back with Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli, your phone calls, and much more next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson on the next Connections. It's Healthy Friday. We have an ACA update in the first hour. We'll talk about state and federal registration numbers and how the ACA will affect your taxes coming up. Second hour, we're talking heroin addiction. It is unfortunately a problem that has not gotten any better in the last 24 months. We'll get you updated on that. That's all coming up Healthy Friday on Connections.
A new season begins for a hugely popular sport. Even though NASCAR viewing is down from previous years, it's still incredibly popular.
20 years ago, no NASCAR race would have ranked in the top 20 primetime shows. Now NASCAR is a top 5 primetime show.
NASCAR on the rise, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli is here. And he's had the interesting position of having been a party chair here. Not the party chair of the Democrats anymore in Monroe County. But let me ask this. Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren was on the program on Tuesday. She told us that she, really like you in many ways, has a bipartisan record of working as you need to with the county executive, Maggie Brooks. Maggie Brooks term limited out of office this fall. The Republicans are going to nominate Cheryl DeNulfo, the county clerk. Warren told me she has a good relationship with Cheryl DeNulfo. And we talked about whether Lovely Warren wants to see a Democrat beat Cheryl DeNulfo. Her answer was interesting. Let's listen, starting with my question about whether Rochester's Democratic mayor might support a Republican in this race. Could you foresee yourself endorsing Cheryl DeNulfo?
I don't know who the Democratic candidate will be, and we'll see.
Do you want to see a strong Democratic candidate?
I think that the Democrats will have to decide as a party who they want as a county executive, and I'll work with whoever the people elect.
You're not the party chair anymore, Joe, but she didn't say immediately, yes, I want a strong Democrat, and she didn't say she wouldn't endorse a Republican. Is that answer good enough for you?
Well, it's not what my answer would be. So my answer would be, obviously, I expect we're going to field a strong candidate and somebody I expect to endorse and work with, and I want a Democrat to be elected county executive for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which is, with all due respect, I think we've had 20-plus years of Republican rule in this county, and the thing that you can't get away from is that it has been a county government mired in questions about their ability to meet the needs of taxpayers while not having preferential treatment for people. There's going to be a trial, presumably the next several months, that questions essentially the foundations of the county government and its ability to provide those services. Kind of, it's not substantially different. We've had these challenges at the state level. So, but I believe a Democrat will do very well. I expect to support them. And I expect that we can be successful.
You cannot sit this one out, can you? I mean, 2007, Maggie Brooks ran essentially unopposed. She had very high approval ratings after her first term. 4 years ago, Sandy Frankel was her opponent and didn't really put up a hard challenge. I know she worked very hard and gave it an earnest shot. But is it a failure if the Democrats sit this out, Joe?
Well, the Democrats are not going to sit this out. I don't think that we can. Obviously, it's not my responsibility any longer to lead that. But I think it's a disservice to the public. Whether people like the system we have or not, and, I think it was Jefferson who said it's the worst system, except it's just better than all the others, is that you can't have accountability in government if you don't have active and loyal opposition, right? One of the things that I said often to Republican business leaders who were contributors to the Democratic Party was, if you want honest, accountable government, if you want people thinking every day that they've got to prove to the public that they're worthy of that support that they get at the ballot box, the way to help do that is to drive competition. I just got through talking about upstate revitalization and the competition among communities because it helps galvanize your thinking. And it reminds you what the priorities are. You need to have that. So it would be a disservice for Democrats and Republicans not to have a strong challenge when it comes to county executive, because it's the most important position in the county government.
844-295-TALK. If you want to join the conversation with Joe Morelli, 844-295-8255. If you missed it, he clarified he will not be the candidate for county executive. Categorically, no on that, despite the wishes from many Democrats I talked to privately. And I don't know who it's going to be. You want to break any news on what you know?
No, luckily, it's someone else's responsibility to do that, which I'm grateful for. But no, I think there are a number of people talking about it. We have some very, very talented people. I think people both in and out of government. I think, look, the end of the day, we need to restore people's confidence at the local government level as well. It's the same challenge that I have in front of me in terms of Albany, that working with the governor and others to try to do at the state level. And so we need to find someone who really sends that message out, who says, I am, above reproach when it comes to these kinds of questions. I will lead with integrity. I will make sure that taxpayers' dollars are spent in an appropriate way, that we mind the bottom line, but we also try to improve the quality of life. But the important thing is you should be able to trust that your government is doing what's in your interest, not what's in their interests.
Now, you said your answer would have been a little different than Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren. There are, some questions about whether the Democratic Party locally has some divide. And I think for years, the construct has always been that I've seen the Republicans are pretty remarkably unified. It's top down. They know the message. They carry it out very effectively. Democrats have a little bit more behind the scenes, maybe debates. And then when you need to, you unite and you try to work together. But I asked Mayor Warren if there's more division now. You know, occasionally you hear that she worked with, of course, with David Gantt. You know, I don't know how closely you work with David Gantt. I know you might not be the best of friends, but you hear that it's David Gantt and Lovely Warren. It's Joe Morelli. Dave Gerritsen's the new party chair. I don't know exactly where he would be in all of this, but I want to listen to what Lovely Warren had to say about whether the party is deeply divided right now.
I work with everyone. And, you know, Majority Leader Morelli and I are working together on this anti-poverty task force that the governor has set up. And we have had many meetings and we've talked. And, you know, at times there are, you know, in the past we have been on separate sides. But when it comes down to the work of the people, we do what we need to do so that they are taken care of. And I think that that's what's most important. And so, and I also work with Dave Gerritsen. And so if the party, you know, comes up with a candidate and are able to field a candidate, then, you know, I will look to see whether my support helps them or rather it hurts them. You know, I think that we have to work together in order to move our community where it needs to go.
The mayor said that in the past, she and you have been on separate sides. Is she referring to her work for David Gantt or something else?
No, I assume what she's referring to is when I was a county chair, I had worked with then-Mayor Tom Richards, mm-hmm. and who received the Democratic designation for the party's, carry the party's banner in that primary. And she obviously challenged it successfully. And so we were on different sides during the primary. But, you know, as soon as the primary is over, I endorsed her. I worked with her. Contributed to her campaign, have continued to try to make sure that I'm a constructive force, not only within the party, but in the community. You know, and I do. It's a good point. I work with a lot of Republicans, and I have high regard for a lot of Republicans that I serve with. Joe Robach is a good friend. We work together on many issues, as I do with Mark Johns, you mentioned. Mark and I are very good friends. We see eye to eye on a lot of things. You know, there are things that we see differently, but not in our – Brian Kolb's another great example. Brian's the minority mm-hmm. leader. We both are from the same region, and there's few people I have higher regard for than Brian Kolb, both as an individual and in terms of his professional capacity. That's not to say, though, that doesn't mean that my work for the Democratic Party to try to find, recruit, and help even to get resources to – quality candidates is an important thing. It's important to me, and probably always will be.
Is your relationship with the mayor as strong as you want it to be?
I think we're working on our relationship every day, as I do with other folks. I think, you know, you mentioned David Gantt. I have respect for him and his position. He chairs the Transportation Committee. David and I don't often see eye to eye, and that's okay. I mean, we can have difference of opinion. That doesn't matter if at the end of the day we're doing the right things or we come together enough to make sure that the people in this district and this community get the resources they need to be successful.
Before I turn it over to the phones to finish the hour, one more question. You mentioned education, a big issue to you and the governor. And it's become a little heated between Governor Cuomo and some teachers. We saw 7 Teachers of the Year send a letter saying they feel personally attacked. The governor is putting more emphasis on evaluations and, in his words, being able to fire bad teachers. Teachers say that misses the point. The biggest issue in places, especially like Rochester, is poverty. What side of that do you fall on, Joe?
Well, I don't believe. Let me say with what I do believe, I guess. I believe that everybody should get evaluated, particularly when you're paid by public dollars. So I get evaluated every other year at the ballot box. People get evaluated in different ways. Teachers aren't going to avoid evaluations, nor should they want to. The question is how to make sure that we're fairly measuring their skills, what they do in the classroom. And I think what's happened is we've ended up with this this fight that's polarized. The governor on the one hand calling out bad teachers, largely the organized unions, NYSET and UFT, calling out the governor for calling out bad teachers. And the problem has been the system which we're used to evaluate doesn't take into account all the other, you know, conditions that are going on in a classroom. And most of the teachers that need improvement are in urban areas where there is high levels of poverty, where there's a fair amount of dysfunction in family units, things that aren't very supportive of education. And teachers feel unfairly targeted because of those circumstances beyond their control. Having said that, you have to some degree, you have to, you know, recalibrate But you have to measure how is someone doing in the classroom, right? If I don't believe any teacher would say what I do in the classroom makes no difference, that the social problems are so big that that I can't affect it. Otherwise, you wouldn't be a teacher. I would think you'd be doing something else. You would be somewhere else, right? So there is something they think they can do that's a value add. We just need to measure whether or not that's a quality value add. So I don't believe this is an either-or discussion. We should have a fair, we should have a robust and a rigorous evaluation system. We should reward teachers that are particularly good and perhaps giving them more responsibility as mentors. We should give improvement opportunities for teachers that are not meeting the grade. And I don't think it has to be simply based on one test, nor do I think it should be on one observation. It's got to be a multiple, way of trying to make those objective determinations.
Gerald in Rochester, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going to try to make this short, but it's a funny story that I've learned to envision the Albany governance over time. I'm 66 years old. My uncle was the Buffalo Evening News bureau chief in Albany, and he used to come down and talk to my dad in Binghamton, New York, and he used to rant and rave and rant and rave about political corruption and political power-making. And I was fascinated by it. And he went and retired in the 1970s or something. My mother sent me a copy of his, the record of his retirement speech in Albany, where most people get up and thank all the buddies that they made in Albany. He just went up and continued to rant and rave about the political structure and the three men in a room business. And so I was painted when I was a youngster. And then I subbed in the Canandaigua School District, and I still remember someone who ran for the state assembly coming in one day as a substitute teacher, and I said, why would you go to a place like that? And she said, well, you have to start somewhere. And I remember driving back on the thruway about some public interest research group recording a list of things that were on people's state lawmakers, same thing as district business, funds for district projects. And there was a swimming pool in some legislator's backyard. And I'm just so turned off, and I think many New Yorkers are turned off at what it's commonly called, in the circles I travel in, a cesspool that is Albany.
All right, Gerald, I got to jump in just because we're going to run out of time if I don't. But Joe, real briefly here, I know you already addressed one of his comments. On three men in a room, you said earlier, that's a little bit overblown. You don't view that that's an accurate description. And even to the extent that it were, you think that that is probably evolving with the change with Sheldon Silver gone?
Well, I think that's true. And by the way, if it were true, I wouldn't have the lines of people asking to meet with me. They would go speak only to Speaker Hastie and to the majority leader in the Senate. But people know that there are many of us who have some influence, or they would like us to be able to opine on the issues that face them. So I think the public understands that it's a gross oversimplification. And I talk to the speaker every day. I speak to the governor actually most days. So I think I'm having some influence, and so I think it's an oversimplification.
Now, he's talking about swimming pools in backyards. I don't know if you have a swimming pool in your backyard.
No, sadly, I don't. It's the one thing I've always wanted, Evan, and I can't get there.
Now, but what's also true is that member items paid for a lot of the more parochial things. Those have gone.
Correct.
I don't know that to the extent that you can still get the cash for some of those parochial projects.
No, I mean, actually, on one level, the small community groups that used to get some member item money can't do that any longer. We now do it through this regional economic development council and consolidated funding applications. So it's become much more, people like to say merit-based. It's not based on just the judgment of an individual legislator. But look, some good things have happened. I know we don't get credit for it because most of the news is about corruption, understandably, and we're as frustrated as anyone when this continues to be an issue. But we have passed four budgets now on time, first time in 30 years. It's been done without fiscal gimmicks. We're at the lowest tax for middle-income tax earners, income tax in 40 years. We've got a better economy. We've got more jobs than we've ever had. We have a surplus now instead of a deficit was in the $10 billion range just a couple of years ago. So a lot of things have happened that are positive. But here's the other thing. If I or others who went to the state legislature felt that we couldn't do any good, that it was just such a bad situation that we could never improve it. I'm not sure what that would say about us. I mean, you know, the challenge is to try to make it better, and I think we're doing a better job. It's a tough state. There's 19 million people. There are a lot of needs, and there's hardly a consensus about what we should do on anything.
Joe's old friend Pete gets 30 seconds. Go ahead, Pete.
Congratulations, Evan. You just broke your own record by 25 minutes, how long I've been waiting on hold to get in this conversation.
Oh, lots of people have to wait, Pete. Go ahead.
Well, if you would discuss something of substance while you have Joe Morelli here, I'd appreciate it.
All right, Pete, call me again on a different day, and we will definitely take your call. John in Rochester, go ahead, John, real briefly.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Joe.
Hey, John.
Sheldon Silver, I have empathy for him. 70 years old, and he's going through this. It's got to be turmoil. But on the other side of it, I think he's really the poster boy for term limits. Anybody that's in that position, take George Maziarz as an example. George was there a long time, and looks like he is under investigation, and I just think it's a natural thing. What kind of irritates me, though, is that the assembly members did not oust Sheldon Silver before this. I mean, he had this so-called bribery or payoff in a sexual harassment case. And I'd like to see the assembly stand up, and they should have booted him out before this.
Okay, John, thanks for the call. 45 seconds, Joe Morelli. First of all, term limits, yes or no?
I've never been a fan of term limits. I think it's actually cripples governments. I've talked to state legislators around the country who have actually proposed and enacted term limits to come back and say, this was a terrible idea.
Why?
We should never have done it. Because I think partly it emboldens and empowers lobbyists who are special interests who will be there their whole career. You're not going to term limit them. The central staff will know all the nuance of government. It takes a long time to be at a place where you can effectively, and I don't know that it has to be 20 years. I've been there 20 years. I mean, you probably could be effective in less time than that. But that amount of time learning complicated governments. And look, as it relates to when the time is to change leadership, obviously I think we did the right thing. And I don't know that I feel the sympathy that John did for the speaker. You know, he's made his bet. He'll have to answer for his decisions. But a lot of good is going on. We're going to continue to change the place for the better, and I appreciate the chance to come on and talk.
Thank you. And if you missed it, Joe Morelli says he does not think this session will get to a budget without ethics reform. We'll see if that's true. And we'll talk to you especially in more detail about poverty and many other things coming up. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli, thanks for all the calls and all the interest these 2 hours. Val, thank you for keeping us on time and the great work she does as an engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Off tomorrow. Have a wonderful weekend. I will talk to you Monday on member-supported public radio.
This program is a production of WXXI Public Radio. The views expressed do not necessarily